Well, one of the best definitions of anarchism I heard was made by Russian Bolshevik leader Bukharin. It was after the revolution. He said that the anarchists have got two rules. First rule is you must not form a political party. The second rule is that nobody must obey the first rule. Which quite neatly shows and there are serious contradictions in the whole conception of anarchism. Now, Marx explained that the working class, without organization, is only one thing: raw material for exploitation. That's all it is. Raw material for exploitation. And through the experience of the workers very soon came to understand the need to organize. You need organization to resist the bosses. That's the only strength that the working class has got, is its unity, its discipline, and its organization. Otherwise, they'd be just that, raw material for exploitation. Because the organization starts on the workshop, it starts in the trade union. Incidentally, of course, there's a very negative feature to the way we know the way in which the workers are exploited and oppressed in the factories and crushed with a kind of dehumanizing, imposed discipline and so on. We know this. And yet, that's also got, I don't know, you've probably seen the film, Charlie Chaplin's film, Modern Times, you know, the workers enslaved to the clock, you clock on, you clock off, and so on. And yet, this very discipline, which is instilled into the workers in a kind of brutal fashion under capitalism, nevertheless has got a positive side. The whole basis of modern industry would be impossible without discipline, without organization, and so on. And the workers learn this organization, they learn this discipline, yes, it's true, from the capitalist system itself. Now, and of course, they turn this organization and this discipline against the oppressors through the trade unions. Now, the conception, the anarchist conception actually is a bourgeois conception. It's based on individualism. You know, the rights of the individual, I declare and I proclaim my complete freedom to do just what I like. No question of any discipline, it's oppression and authority, anti-authoritarianism, that was the slogan of the anarchists. And as Engels replied to Bakunin, he says, have these gentlemen ever seen, there's a very interesting article by Engels, I think we should publish it, called On Authority. Not very long. He says, have these gentlemen ever seen a revolution? A revolution, he says, is the most authoritarian thing you could imagine. By definition, a revolution is a situation where one class overcomes and therefore, by definition, oppresses another class and submits it to its will. This is highly authoritarian, but that's what a revolution is. Now, the conception, by the way, that you can do without leadership, you can do without authority in that, is entirely false. As a matter of fact, even in the most spontaneous strike, a strike of half an hour, there's always leadership. For the simple reason, not all the workers can go into the office and talk to the boss. Therefore, they will elect, from their number, they will elect a leadership, people that they feel represent them. Why? It's not an accident, but they don't pull a name out of a hat. There's Joe Bloggs, or Bill Smith, or whoever. They will elect those natural leaders of the working class on the basis that they're the most militant, the most determined, the most intelligent, the most conscious elements, people that were best prepared to take on the bosses. You see this repeated time and again in every strike. Now, anarchism as a theory, well, there's not so much of a theory to it, as a matter of fact. The original idea of Bakunin, I suppose you'd have to say that Bakunin was the founder of anarchism as a movement. Bakunin didn't have much theory. Marx said in the letter, this man has got no theory whatsoever, but he's an excellent intriguer. Bakunin was an excellent. By the way, it is most astonishing that this man who claimed to be anti-authoritarian inside his own organization was an absolute tyrant, and that's a law. I've seen this repeated many times. Absolutely. He had a secret organization where he lorded over his fellow conspirators. No question of any democracy there. It's a complete tyrannical setup. And he dedicated himself to intrigue. I'll deal with that in a moment. But as for his theories, well, the theories are quite childish. There's no theory attached. All that he did, he didn't have any ideas of his own. Bakunin never had an idea in his head. He had no ideas of his own. But he just took a rag bag, a miscellany of half-digested concepts of the utopian sources, the pre-Marxian sources, of particularly Saint-Simon, people like that. And of course, Proudhon. Proudhon, which was a half-baked utopian socialist. And a reformist, by the way, who did not believe in political action because he didn't believe in revolution, as a matter of fact. He's a complete reformist, a non-revolutionary. Bakunin took his utopian notions from these people and mixed it and jumbled it up with all kind of ultra-left demagogy and all kinds of nonsense. And so, but at a certain stage, Bakunin attached himself to the First International. Now, I should say a few things about the First International. Incidentally, Marxists have always been internationalists, that goes without saying, not just in words but in deeds. And, for example, Marx never had the conception of creating a German party. Lenin never had the conception of building a Russian party. Rosa Luxemburg never had the conception of building a Polish party. They all, from the very beginning, posed the question of an international organization. And therefore, in 1864, if my memory doesn't fail me, or 1863, I can't remember, you had the formation in London, actually, of the International Working Man's Association, the IWA, the First International, as it's known historically. Now, of course, this was an early attempt to form an international, and we have to be clear that it wasn't yet, leastways at the beginning, it wasn't even based on Marxism. Karl Marx formed part of the leadership of the international. He played an important role in the General Council, which is based in London. But there were all kinds of people mixed up in this, as you'd expect. All kinds of confused elements. Followers of Proudhon in France. English trade unionists, reformists in effect. Utopian socialists of all sorts. It was followers of Mazzini, Italian nationalists and so on, Polish nationalists. It was a mixed bag. And Marx worked in this in order to try to put forward the ideas of scientific socialism, as we do now with the IMT, with Socialist Appeal. We don't stand aside from the general movement of the working class, from the labour movement as such, but we try to fight for Marxist ideas, for scientists, to clarify the ideas then, and to fight for a scientific programme, a revolutionary programme within the movement. That's what Marx and Engels did. And there's a marvellous letter, actually, by Marx. I think he was writing to Engels, and he said, he explained you have to have a lot of patience. You do have to have a lot of patience when conducting this work in the mass organizations. He said, when dealing particularly with the English reformists, when dealing with these people, he said, I had to be mild in manner and bold in content. That's a wonderful expression. Mild in manner and bold in content. And Marx was very patient, and eventually it paid off, because the influence of the ideas of Marx and Engels became the dominant ideas in the international. But of course, it still met with resistance from certain sectors. And it's not an accident, by the way, that the ideas of Bakunin had no support whatsoever in the north of Europe. None. But that's it, that the countries like England and Germany in particular, England, even France, he wasn't very strong, as a matter of fact. In the north of Europe, in Britain in particular, of course, that was the country where capitalism developed the furthest at that stage, you only had these half-baked ideas, these utopian ideas, only had a little bit of a base in the more backward countries of the southern part of Europe. They were extremely backward at that time, such as Spain, Italy, and Switzerland actually had a bit of a base among small artisans, not industrial workers, small artisans in the Jura Federation. Was one of the main bases of Bakuninism. Now, the International did marvellous work. I can't go into this work. Wonderful work in for example, intervening in strikes. It was practical work as well as theoretical work. So they were engaged in practical activity. And, of course, a very important historical event which directly affected the International was the Paris Commune. A war broke out between Prussia and what is now Germany, Prussia and France in 1870. It was an adventure by the French, actually, by Louis Bonaparte. His regime was very shaky, so he decided to launch a war, typical of a person in that position. They wanted to carve up Germany, in effect, and seize the Rhine. The French imperialists always had that conception of seizing the Rhineland. They considered it should be their property. Well, it failed, of course. He got a bloody nose. The Prussians smashed them. By the way, initially, Marx was, of course, didn't support the Prussians, didn't support the Prussian, Bismarck and the Prussian reaction to the Junkers, as they were called. But nevertheless, he did explain that the role of France was particularly reactionary because they wanted to carve up Germany. They wanted to and German unity was a fundamental democratic demand at that time. So initially, Marx denounced the actions of the French. But the International clearly took a position against the war, and on both sides, both the German comrades and the French comrades actually staged acts of solidarity. Some of them ended up in jail as a result of that. Bebel, for example, in Germany. I think Liebknecht also was imprisoned for anti-war activity. But of course, Marx warned from the very beginning that it's one thing for the Germans to defend themselves against French aggression. It's another thing for the war to become transformed into a war of aggression, for the conquest of the French people or the seizure of Alsace-Lorraine, which is actually what happened. They smashed the French army at the Battle of Sedan, which led to the collapse of the Bonapartist regime. And then something which astonished the world. The French workers moved. They seized Paris without any real leadership and so on. They took over. And they set up the Paris Commune, which Marx says was an historic event. The first workers' state in the world. By the way, they did, contrary to the theories of Bakunin, they did form a state, a worker state. The armed people, that's what a worker state is. It was a state power. A very democratic, not like a normal state. It was what, as Engels said, it was a semi-state. He actually, I think it was Marx used that expression. Semi-state. Because it's not like a state of a minority oppressing the majority, which all other states have been. It was a worker state. The first worker state, the dictatorship of the proletariat, used that expression. Because people today don't understand what it means. It was the most, there was nothing totalitarian or bureaucratic about this. It was the most democratic state that's ever been seen on the face of the earth, with the recall of all officials, no official to receive a higher wage than a worker, and the armed people and things of this character. It was a marvellous thing, but of course it failed. Marx thought it was going to fail because it was, for certain reasons, partly because of the mistakes of the communards. Incidentally, Bakunin tried his experiment prior to this, before the commune. There was an uprising in Lyon. I forgot the date of that. Was it September 1870? So there was an uprising of the workers in Lyon. He immediately turned up. He came straight from Switzerland. Turned up at the town hall, declared anarchism. But of course, being an anarchist, he didn't take any elementary precautions like setting up an armed force or a workers' guard or even posting a guard on the door. So two divisions of the National Guard, of the bourgeois National, were quite sufficient to disperse that. They actually came in through the door. But the town hall where Bakunin was sitting writing his proclamations, because he hadn't even bothered to post a guard. This is the stupidity of the anarchists. The bourgeois just snuffed that out. And of course Bakunin scuttled back to Switzerland without having anything except to sow confusion, which is the role of anarchists, to sow confusion and disorientation and disorganization wherever they go. Now this was the dramatic setting then. The commune was defeated. Partly defeated by its own mistake. One remark. The Italian revolutionary nationalist Garibaldi, who was, Marx had some time for Garibaldi, although he was a bourgeois nationalist, not a socialist. But Bakunin has actually approached Garibaldi. When he broke with Mazzini, they tried to influence him, and they sent him a letter talking about anarchy and anti-authoritarianism, and he wrote back to them a polite letter saying, well, it's very I appreciate your kind words and so on, but you must understand, my friends, that the Paris Commune was defeated not because it was authoritarian, but because it wasn't authoritarian enough. Even Garibaldi understood that elementary fact of life. Anyway, it's an interesting point that Bakunin started this political life not in the workers' movement, not in the First International, but in a bourgeois outfit called the League for Peace and Freedom, I think it was called. The League for Peace, a bourgeois outfit completely. He started to mess around with that. I think he wanted to be the leader. Oh, it's curious that the man that was against authority and leadership, he always wanted to be the leader with a capital L. He tried it on in this outfit, and of course he didn't get any. When he failed, then he turned his attention to another organization, which was the First International. And he entered that with a view to spreading his nonsense, spreading his nonsensical anarchist ideas, which had nothing to do with the ideas of the First International. And he did this in a very sly way, very devious way, setting up a secret organization behind the backs of the International. And he started an immediate campaign against the leadership of the International. Bakunin wasn't a fool. He knew that he had a problem. The problem was the General Council in London and Marx, the authority of Marx. Therefore, in order for his intrigue to succeed, he had to undermine that leadership at all costs. And he did so in quite an unscrupulous fashion. Behind the backs of the movement, using intrigue and so on, he'd send his people to different sections to start spreading the word. No, the problem here is the leaders. The problem here is an authoritarian leadership, you know. These terrible people in London, this terrible General Council, this terrible Karl Marx. What you need is autonomy, complete autonomy, see, for all the nationals. This was you read it yourself, this was the line. And of course, Marx and Engels eventually realized what was occurring. They couldn't initially do much about it. Incidentally, Bakunin, you see, the level of these people, he stooped to the lowest kind of insults and slanders. For example, during the Franco-Prussian War, obviously, the national feelings were inflamed. The French, of course, had a grievance against the Germans, the Prussians, and he started to put it around and he said, no, Marx is a German. And all Germans are authoritarian. He wrote this. All Germans are authoritarian by nature. And he's a Jew. Yes, he stooped to anti-Semitism. Bakunin was anti-Semite. There's numerous anti-Semitic remarks. Problem is, Marx is a German Jew, and this, therefore he's an authoritarian, this kind of stuff. So he stooped to the lowest possible level in order to personally discredit Marx and personally discredit the General Council. This continued for some time, but eventually, of course, Marx, Engels, the General Council went on a counter-offensive. They challenged the political, first of all, in political terms. You must deal with people like this in political terms. And he raised the question of Bakunin's rejection of political action. You know, the workers mustn't get involved in politics. That sounds very radical, you know. We're revolutionaries, don't want to set up a political party. And Marx explains, by this formula, You condemn the workers to follow the bourgeois parties, the liberal parties that exist. Now, curiously enough, I said that Bakunin didn't have any support, any effect in England, and that's true, he didn't. But there were, Marx and Engels had to fight on different fronts. The main front was to fight against the Bakuninists. They were the most dangerous. As Marx said, this man is a dangerous intriguer who's trying to disorganize and disorient the international. But he had other people that didn't sympathize with him. They had their own axe to grind. For example, on the General Council, there were reformist trade unionists, English trade unionists, reformist trade unionists, that were in fact deeply suspicious of revolution. And particularly the Paris Commune shook them. A man called John Hales, who was an English trade unionist, he was the General Secretary, actually, on the General Council. They were shaken by the Paris Commune, they were frightened by the Paris Commune, and they began to react against the revolutionary wing, if you like. And therefore, although they didn't have anything whatsoever to do with Bakunin, politically they were completely opposite. By the way, Hales was an English chauvinist. He wanted to make the Irish workers accept the leadership of the English, of the British Federal Council, as it was so called, which was rejected, I think, with one vote in favour. That was Hales' own vote. But there was this movement, this clique. They had another problem in America, completely of a different nature. Whereas in Europe, particularly at the time of the Paris Commune, the bourgeois were terrified of the international and didn't want anything to do with it. The international was the bogeyman. They hated and feared it. But in America it was different. There was no danger of revolution in America. It was very far away from the Paris Commune. And paradoxically, at that time, a certain part of the bourgeoisie in the middle class, it was chic, it was the thing to be a socialist and a communist. You know, it didn't mean anything. And therefore, the New York branch, Section 12 of the International in New York, was actually taken over by a couple of bourgeois feminists. A wealthy lady, I've forgotten her name, what's her name? Woodruff, I think, or I've forgotten her name, it doesn't matter, you can check it out. But she was a wealthy banker, actually. And she had a lot of money. And she decided she wanted to buy an international or buy a... So she took over the New York branch. She had a paper run by her and her sister, Caitlin. I can't remember the name, but the name of the paper was the name of the two sisters, actually. It was a weekly. Yeah, they had plenty of cash. Spreading bourgeois ideas of bourgeois feminism, you know, for example, that the emancipation of women must come before the socialist revolution, and it's more important than socialism, this, that, and the other. And of course, this was alienating the workers. Particularly, the most militant section of the workers in America were not the Native Americans, but the Germans and the Poles and the Irish and the Jews and so on. So the French, they were alienated by this bourgeois clique. And Marx didn't think twice about it. He moved that they'd be kicked out without contemplation, which is what occurred. The workers split away. He also moved that any section of the international must have at least two-thirds workers, members, as to combat the pernicious influence of the middle class, what we would call today the trendy lefties, and there's too many of them around, you know. You find that when the workers' movement is at a very low ebb, it can affect even the workers' movement. You get all kinds of feminists and pacifists and greens and all kinds of middle-class deviations. Nothing to do with the working class, nothing to do with socialism. Unfortunately, that exists in more than one country. The influence of these groups is evident. So Marx took firm action in relation to this clique in New York. They were expelled at the Hague Congress in 1870. Under certain circumstances, expulsion is necessary to preserve the movement. Anyway, Bakunin's intrigues continued. Particularly after the defeat of the Commune, when the international was objectively in a very difficult position, you can imagine it. A police state in France, a police state in Germany, comrades in prison, the international driven to the most difficult conditions. And in the middle of all this damned intrigue, all the time, intrigue, causing quarrels and splits and rows in one section after another, which they did systematically, deliberately. To some extent, it was connected with the state. It's proven that Marx deals with that. There were police spies involved with Bakunin. It's a fact. But in any case, with or without police spies, this intrigue caused considerable damage. Eventually, it was challenged. It was brought out into the open. The International made it clear that they stood for political action and they stood for the creation of a political party of the working class. So they were politically defeated. And then at the Hague Congress, the General Council called a Congress in the Hague in 1872, I can't remember the date, in which Bakunin and a few other of the leaders were expelled. Now, it'd be interesting to deal with, I think we will deal with this in writing, because there's many lessons to be drawn from this fact. But to go back, just to raise the point, because even today, although Bakunin is long gone, but and anarchism, really speaking, as a movement is finished. It did have considerable strength after this, in Spain particularly, and they played a very pernicious role in Spain. Although the rank and file anarchists, workers, were very heroic people. Very heroic people, but the leaders, and how can you have anarchist leaders? But there always have been anarchist leaders. The worst kind of bureaucrats you could imagine. Always been present. So that's just nonsense, this business about no leaders. Now, you see, although anarchism doesn't exist, but anarchist ideas exist. And anarchist ideas still have a certain audience, not among the working class. Workers are not anarchists. A worker enters a factory and learns very quickly the need for organization, discipline, and so on. But among the petty bourgeoisie and among the lumpen proletariat, and that's the real class basis of anarchism. Anarchism is the communism of the lumpen proletariat, isn't it? But it attracts the petty bourgeois types. I've noticed over the years that many petty bourgeois are attracted by lumpens. They think that the lumpens are working class, which is a very sad confusion. The lumpen proletariat has got nothing to do with the working class whatsoever. But what argument is put forward? Well, the argument is, well, you don't need leaders, you don't need centres, you don't need... This is bureaucracy, you see, by definition. Which, of course, is nonsense. Now, the problem is, by the way, I noticed it when, for my sins, I was a student for several years, and I noticed this among the most anti-democratic and bureaucratic groups you could imagine are precisely the anarchist groups. Mm-hmm. Now, look, history has evolved certain mechanisms, democratic mechanisms. The working class has struggled for democracy. The working class had to struggle to get the vote. The struggle to have the right to organize. Struggle to have the right to... None of this was ever conceded by the ruling class. It had to be conquered. The working class conquered democracy. And the working class, by the way, must defend democracy. Now, democracy, bourgeois democracy, we know, has got serious limits. But the alternative is far worse. And incidentally, nobody has ever shown us a better system than democratically electing representatives. You know, you elect a Congress. The Congress, democratically, after a debate and a discussion, elects a leadership to act in its name, on its behalf. Why? Because it is just that, what are you going to do? You're going to say that everyone must decide 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year, on every issue. How are you going to do this? By internet? Some people believe it can be done by internet. Well, you know, internet is a very good thing, and it's a very useful weapon, but it's the source of colossal information. Sometimes I think there's a bit too much information. It's also the source of a colossal amount of misinformation, of lies, of nonsense, of idiocy. You know, and of course, the question is, with the internet, you don't need an organization, you don't need a party, you don't need anything like that, elections, nothing like that. One man and a dog can sit behind a computer, if he's got the time to do it, and create the impression, the false impression, that he represents something, when he represents nothing but himself. This impression can be created, and has been created. I know of one website, I won't mention any names, not to offend anybody, I know of one socialist website, which is literally, there's a tiny group of people based in America, And all they do is website, 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 and that's it. Virtual politics. Now, the word virtual, you can seek the meaning in the dictionary, you know. As far as I know, virtual means almost, but not quite. Almost real, but not quite. So you have a virtual party, a virtual trade union, a virtual revolution, virtual socialism, you know. Almost, but not quite. In point of fact, and I must make it clear that I'm in favour of, completely in favour of, utilising the internet and modern technology, although I'm woefully inadequate on that point, but I'm in favour of it. It's very important. Yes, but you mustn't exaggerate. I've noticed, for example, that the idea that the internet can be instead of a newspaper, instead of meetings, instead of conferences, you don't need a congress to vote. You just sit down and tick-a-tick-a-tick-a-tick-a-tick. I've seen some people sitting at conferences in our own international. They're like crazed concert pianists, you know, ticky 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 ticky, not participating in the discussion, the debate, not even listening to the that thing. Now, what is democratic about that? It's not democratic at all. Democracy is where I have the right in my branch to discuss, to debate, to reach a decision in which, regrettably, the majority decides. Very sorry about that, you know, it's a very sad state of affairs. But one must, if one is a Democrat, you must accept, I believe, that if I cannot convince the people sitting around this table of the correctness of my position, if I'm in a minority, then it's sad to say, I must accept the position of the majority. For example, in a strike, workers understand this, you discuss, you debate, you can have quite heated as to whether or not the strike is justified, whether it's correct, and so on. But at the end of the day, because it's not a discussion club, like you find in student university, you can discuss anything till the cows come home and never ever decide anything. And nobody cares a damn. But in the working class, it's not like that. You have to reach a decision. And the minority, always, I would say, 9 times out of 10, workers understand this and they do accept. They do accept. A worker will vote against a strike, but if he's outvoted, he'll go along. He might even be on the picket line the next day. That's how the workers see these things. And you know the best example of an anarchist? The finest representative of the freedom of the individual against all restrictions on his free will? It's a scab. It's a scab. When a scab turns up and says, no, I'm not accepting this, I'm going to work anyway, bugger you. And of course the bourgeois press reminds us of this, but if there's a strike, they pick out one or two sad individuals, or declassed, lumpen types usually, who defy the opinion of the majority, go into work, and of course they're held up as great heroes. Well, the workers, I'm very sorry, workers don't see it like that. And they treat these scabs as they ought to be treated. No. The minority must accept the reason. Of course, you reserve the right then to argue your case at some future occasion, try to convince people that you're correct. No harm in that. And then, of course, you elect a delegate. Horror of horrors. You know, I'm sacrificing part of my freedom because this man is speaking in my... No. The delegate is elected by the majority because he or she represents the views of the majority. Goes to a conference, defends his point of view, same thing applies. And this is how leadership is elected, whether it's in a union or the Labour Party or the Socialist Appeal or any other half-decent democratic organisation. Now, to confuse this conception of democracy, this is a recipe for bureaucracy and for tyranny and for authoritarianism, is not just a nonsense, it is a dangerous nonsense. It's a dangerous nonsense because if that were accepted, the inescapable logic would be the dissolution of any organisation. Doesn't matter whether it's the Socialist Appeal, the IMT, trade union, or the Boy Scouts. You dissolve any organisation. Now, some people believe that organisations shouldn't exist. These are anarchist conceptions, you know. And it's very easy, it's a simple matter, of course, to explain to somebody that seeing the monstrous bureaucracy of the Labour Party, right, the control of the right wing, the trade unions and so on and so forth, the behaviour of the parliamentarians who become separated from the class, of course. It's very easy that someone would have prejudices about that, would have a healthy instinct, and many workers, of course, and many honest anarchists in the past had a healthy instinct against bureaucracy, and we are opposed to bureaucracy, of course, in favour of the control of the rank and file, naturally. But the question arises that you can abuse and play upon those prejudices and those understandable fears for all kinds of unscrupulous purposes, for intrigues and for confusing everything. Because incidentally, it is not true, it simply is not true, that all leaders inevitably become corrupt. Many workers think that because it corresponds to their experience. But for example, Lenin and Trotsky were not corrupt. They didn't abandon the cause of the working class. And if we thought that, then of course the outlook would be very bleak indeed. But it's not true. It simply is not true. Naturally, there must be mechanisms of control in any organization, that goes without saying. The leadership can be removed, but they can be removed how? Not by an irresponsible clique that starts shouting and bawling and spreading stuff over the internet and stuff of that character. Incidentally, if you accepted that position, that will lead directly to the worst kind of bureaucracy, ruled by cliques, ruled by self-appointed cliques, people that have never been elected by anybody, are not responsible to anybody, cannot be removed by anybody, but just suddenly appear as if by magic, you know, to attack the elected leadership. Now, there's a very simple solution. If you are not satisfied with the leadership, then of course you have a right and a duty to fight for an alternative leadership. But the idea that you can do without leadership, because leadership per se is bad, is a nonsense. Let me give you a case in point. Let us say that I buy a pair of new shoes, this happened to me frequently, as you know, and the shoes pinch, so the shoes are hurting me. What conclusion do you draw from that? You draw the conclusion, oh, the shoes hurt me, therefore I go around barefoot. Is that the conclusion you draw? I don't think so. I think the conclusion you draw is, I don't like these shoes, they don't suit me, therefore I get a better pair of shoes. Or you live in a bad house, the house is leaking, the room is leaking, it's got damp, you're catching cold and so on. What do? You want to live on the streets? I don't think so. You would attempt, by all means, to get a better accommodation. Now, why should it be any different? Or fix the house, yes, precisely. Or fix the house. Very good point. Now, why should it be any different with the working class organisations? You know, the leadership of the Labour Party is bad, and therefore some people say, well, we don't need the Labour Party. Well, yes, therefore we require another leadership. The leadership of my trade union is bad, of course, unspeakably bad, very bad. What are you going to do? You fight for an alternative leadership. What you don't say is, we do not require leadership in general. It's not even logical. It doesn't even comply with the laws of formal logic, never mind the laws of revolutionary socialism and Marxism. No, I'll finish on this note. The working class needs organisation. Organisations must have a leadership. And it's up to everyone concerned that participates in any organisation, whether it's the Labour Party, the trade unions, or our tendency, to ensure that you have the best possible leadership available. But the idea that you can do without a leadership equals, without the shadow of a doubt, the dissolution of the organisation. It is clear. It's absolutely clear. And what is required in the struggle against capital, after all, capital is organised, capital is centralised, and how? The state is centralized. That's part of their power. In order to combat that state, we also require a disciplined, organized, and centralized organization. One final word, another argument they come. I heard this recently. I can't remember who put it forward. I got a rough idea. It says, oh, no. If we have a centralized party, a centralized revolutionary party, this will lead not to socialism, but to tyranny and to dictatorship and totalitarianism. That the party, according to the chap who was saying this, the party must be the same as socialism, must be completely same as the socialist future communism. This was said. This was said to me recently. Now, what's the answer to that? Well, you see, the party, the revolutionary party, is not a copy, a carbon copy of the future communist class of society. It is an instrument, a weapon for obtaining such a society. Now, for example, if you want to make a chair, you require a saw, a sharp saw. Yes, but a saw should not resemble a chair. Just imagine a saw that resembled a chair. It wouldn't be a very comfortable chair, and in fact it would be something fit for nothing. Fit for nothing. And the whole wretched demagogy, oh, we must imitate the future society and so on. That's also demagogy that is fit for nothing, except contempt. No, no, no. The instrument which is required by the working class is precisely an organized, disciplined, yes, and, well, of course, democratic, that goes without saying, but a democratic centralist organization on the same lines as any shop stewards committee, any serious strike committee, would also be run, of course, on a more elaborate and a more developed basis. Only by such means would it be possible for us to tackle the bourgeois state, which is an extremely centralized and powerful organization, overthrow it, and of course lead the working class, whose leadership is necessary, in the class war the same as any other war. Just imagine a war, you say, oh, generals are not necessary, you just try it. How many times in history has a big army been defeated by a small professional army with good generals? Many times. And in the war between nations, leadership is absolutely necessary, and in the war between classes, it is also necessary. To deny that is a recipe for what happened to Bakunin when he went to France, went to Lyon on that particular occasion, and forgot to post a guard. But we're not going to act like Bakunin, we're going to act like Marx, Engels, Lenin, Trotsky. That's our basis, that's our tradition, that's our policies, and that's our organization. Because we also have a principle of organization, which is precisely what I've just attempted to outline.